Gilchrist moves over behind Kemp. He goes back to pass again. Runs out to the right.
Still on his feet. Now throws. It's good to Loughlin.
At the 10. At the 5. Touchdown! Touchdown!
The John Murphy Show is on the air.
He is sacked. He is brought down by Kiko Alonso. And there's your ball game.
That's game time right there. That's game time right there.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the greatest show in sports.
10-yard line, 5, into the end zone. Touchdown, Leonis, my man!
Hear all the action, all the excitement of Buffalo Bills football, right here on
The John Murphy Show.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, supplying natural gas and electricity to thousands of homes and businesses across Western New York. Our final show in Orchard Park before training camp, and we're going to talk about who else? E.J. Manuel. We'll talk with an analytics expert from Pro Football Focus about the improvement rate for second-year quarterbacks after their first year in the league. Coming up at 8 o'clock, former Bills linebacker Chris Draft will be on the line with us. He's conducting the player engagement lecture for the Bills this weekend at training camp, and we'll talk about technology and how it's applied to marketing in the NFL at 8:30.
At the 5, heads to the end zone, touchdown, C.J. Spiller.
Live from One Bills Drive, this is the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.
We turn the page after tonight. We turn the page and look at training camp after tonight. I was just looking back. We've been focused on this little transition ever since last, December 30th was the Monday after the season ended last year, when the long, dark, extra long offseason begins for the Buffalo Bills. And here we are on the cusp of a new season. Pretty exciting. Really pumped about it. A new season coming up, starting with training camp tomorrow. We'll be there tomorrow night, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. with the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, live from Bills training camp. And we just confirmed our guest tomorrow night, 7:30, is going to be Doug Whaley, general manager of the Buffalo Bills. He'll be live with us at training camp tomorrow night at 7:30. So we're looking forward to that tomorrow from training camp. That's a way to get it started, to have the GM in there to talk about the team that he's assembled. I mean, think about it. Since December 30th, the day I just referenced, the day after the Bills lost in New England, Doug Whaley's been at work. I mean, it's been his team. It's been his vision since December 30th, this last offseason. And we've kind of been chronicling it all the way along since December 30th. With the end of the season, a couple of changes there, the Senior Bowl at the end of third week of January or so, followed by the Combine towards the end of February, followed by the owners' meetings in late March, and then the run-up to the draft and the draft in May, and then OTAs, mini-camps, couple of week break, and here we are on the cusp of the 2014 training camp. That's what we want to talk with you about. And as you know, I've been at this for a while. I know many of you, our listeners, both locally and all over the Bills Nation, have been to training camps in the past. The question we put on the table tonight to get your thoughts on, what's your favorite memory of Bills training camps past? What happened that you saw? Who did you talk to? Who did you meet? What play did you see? What player did you get an autograph from? You can go back as far as you want. Your favorite memory from Buffalo Bills training camp. You can go far back as the Knox Farm training camp in 1960. Last night we had on Michelle Zumwalt from NFL Films, and I was doing some research on the NFL Films, highlight films. I had a chance to watch about 10 or 15 minutes online of the very first Buffalo Bills highlight film, 1960. And you probably know this. They trained at Knox Farm in East Aurora, the Polo Grounds. And they actually had film on this highlight film of the players running through the goalposts out onto the polo fields that are still there in East Aurora. They stayed at the Roycroft, which if you've been around East Aurora, you know the Roycroft is, I don't know what it was like back in 1960, in the summer of 60. Hard to imagine 50 or whatever, however many players they have, cramming into the Roycroft Inn in East Aurora and making that their training camp headquarters. Now, I know it's 50-plus years ago, but I just don't see that now. But if you were there at Knox Farm, if you remember that training camp, let us know. If you were at Niagara watching training camp in the late 60s, early 70s, I was there. I grew up in Lockport, 20 minutes away from Niagara University. We used to go down there at least once a summer to watch the Buffalo Bills train. You'd stand behind the snow fences in those wide-open fields at Niagara. Wasn't much of a campus, quite frankly, back then. A lot of the construction's grown up there since in the 30 or 40 years since the Bills have been there. But you'd stand outside the snow fence, wait for the players to come off. They had, as I recall, a pretty long walk to the locker room there at Niagara, and you could get all the autographs you wanted. This is when I was a little kid in the mid to late 60s. I wrote about that in a piece that appeared on BuffaloBills.com a week or so ago. I mean, those are my earliest training camp memories, Niagara University. Maybe you were around Fredonia what a great time that was and what a great site it was for training camp back in that era. The State University at Fredonia, SUNY at Fredonia. Great setup, fan-friendly, autograph central. The one fly in the ointment might have been the golf carts, the ever-present golf carts that every player seemed to have. They would zip through the crowd sometime if they didn't want to sign autographs and head over to the dorms for dinner. But the golf carts got wide usage. I recall players having the golf cart company take the governors off the golf cart so they could really they could go about 30 or 40 miles an hour. Sometimes players use them to frequent night spots in downtown Fredonia, believe it or not. Driving right down the middle of the street in a golf cart, unlicensed. Probably better that way. Anyway, Fredonia, great site for Bills training camp. And I wrote about that, too, some of the memories I had of that. Meeting with John Butler in a super air-conditioned suite after practice, talking about the day's events. Having a long conversation deep into the night with Bill Polian, the then general manager, about the onset, the incoming free agency just a couple of years away and what that might mean. He was a genius when it came to how the league would be structured. I mean, Fredonia was just outstanding. Talking with Ralph Wilson, the late Ralph Wilson, about marketing football. This is late 1998, or in the 1998 season, when the Bills were trying to sell suites and luxury boxes and at Rich Stadium at the time. Just great conversations, great laid-back atmosphere. The people in Chautauqua County and Fredonia were outstanding, outstanding hosts for Bills training camp. But the Bills, and really the NFL, outgrew that and made the move in 2000 to St. John Fisher College. And what a camp that has been. And what great memories from those camps with Wade Phillips, the head coach, riding around in his golf cart. There were carts that first year, and Wade would ride around with a cap that just said coach on it. Didn't have a Bills logo, just said coach. He wanted everybody to know he was the coach. Autographs have always been a big part of the Fisher experience with the way it's set up and the access. I will tell you this. And to my mind, in the three training camps I've attended, there is no place better than St. John Fisher College for fan viewing of the practices, fan access to the players, and it's all organized and set up. It's a little bit corporate now with the sponsorships and the corporate VIP tents, and Fisher has their own corporate setup, but it's really the best setup that I can think about when it comes to training camp and the best that I've ever seen. We want to get your memories of Bills training camp from years gone by. And the phone lines are open. 803-0550 is the number to call. Toll free 1-888-550-2550. You can reach out and follow us on Twitter as well. Just go to @JohnMurphyShow. Your favorite memories of Bills training camp over the years, assuming that you've been there. And if you haven't, make a point over the next month or so. You got an extra long training camp coming up this year. Make a point to come out and see what it looks like for yourself. You'll never have better access. You'll never have closer access to the Bills or the practices than you will over the next few months of training camp. And, of course, the first practice is on Sunday. Our producer, Jay Harris, Chautauqua County native. Did you ever go to training camp before you became an accredited media member, Jay?
All the time. At Fredonia.
Fredonia, yeah.
My uncle worked on the grounds, had a golf cart, and would take us around. And my favorite memory is showing up and meeting Marv Levy, getting an autograph from him. Actually, my father told me, hey, you got to meet Marv Levy. You got to meet Marv Levy. So I went up to Marv Levy. I said, hi, I'm supposed to meet you. And then that was it. And then he goes, you want me to sign your football? I said, yes, yes, please. So got a signed football by him, Thurman, and Jim Kelly, all on one football.
There's three Hall of Famers.
Three Hall of Famers.
Where is that ball now?
Well, okay. I wanted to end it right there. My father, if he's listening, is shaking his head right now because what ensued after that, I decided, well, maybe I'll put blame on my brother. How about that? We'll take the easy way out. Took it outside and decided to play catch with it. And, yeah, you know, a few times it might have hit the ground, but it didn't get bad until it rolled down the sewer. And we had to. I can just see him now putting his hand in his head, or his head in his hand, shaking
his
head.
That's Hall of Famers on there.
Went down, got it. I don't know where it is right now. I'm sure it's around somewhere, but it's not what it, you. I bet you couldn't even read the autographs on there.
It's terrible. Did I ever tell you about my Bills football story, my Super Bowl ball? Bill Polian gave me one of the commemorative Super Bowl balls back in the Super Bowl era, and I brought it home to my boys were young at the time, Mark and Jack, and I said, fellas, this is a significant ball. You just want to keep this on a shelf somewhere. Don't be throwing it around. Don't be playing with it. So it's, you know, the end of the Super Bowl. It's last week of January, first week of February. Oh, yeah, okay, Dad, all right. 2 months later, the snow melts in Orchard Park, and in our backyard, as the snow melts, the ball reveals itself,
no.
And they left it out all winter long, and it was ruined.
John, I've – you know,
what is that?
Growing up, I've been in trouble. I've been yelled at, whatever. But that look of disappointment will never. I knew I did something wrong when I saw that look of disappointment.
Unbelievable. All right. Well, let's hear it from you. Training camp memories. The phone lines are open. 803-0550 is the number. You're going to have a hard time topping that story from Jay Harris. 803-0550 if you're in the local area code. Outside, toll free, 1-888-550-2550. Lines available right now. I think we gave you the lineup. We're going to talk about E.J. Manuel at the bottom of this hour. Gordon McGinnis from ProFootballFocus.com has written an interesting study using analytics on the progression of first-round quarterbacks from year one to year two. It bodes pretty well for E.J. Manuel. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Chris Draft, former Bills linebacker. He was here in the 2009 season. He's got a lot going on, but he is one of the NFL's player engagement ambassadors, and he's coming to St. John Fisher College this weekend to talk to the Bills about locker room culture and about the proper locker room culture. We'll talk with Chris Draft about that coming up at 8 o'clock. And at 8:30, we're going to talk about technology and the use of technology and marketing pro football. We're going to talk with Lauren Johnson of Adweek. That's coming up at 8:30 tonight. We want to hear from you, your favorite training camp memories. Give us a call. 803-0550 is the number. Toll free 1-888-550-2550, or you can do it via Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at John Murphy Show. And we'll start with Mark in Buffalo. Mark, your favorite training camp memory.
In Fredonia for training, and we got out of training early one day. And we said, no, let's go down and see the Bills practice. This was in the mid-80s. We're standing along a snow fence where the players were going to walk by, and there's a group of ladies in front of us. And all of a sudden, these ladies start screaming, here he comes, here he comes. So we're standing on our tippy toes trying to see over these ladies to see who's coming. It was Van Miller. And these ladies start screaming, Van, Van, Van. And it was like, and I still remember that to this day. And I'll be honest with you, John, out of all the players I wanted to see get a Super Bowl ring in the early 90s, I wanted to see Van Miller
absolutely
get a Super Bowl ring. And I wish he would have got one.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great story. Van had that effect on people. Obviously, in Fredonia, Dunkirk, Fredonia, he was a local legend because he grew up down there. But I had an experience with Van. This is not a training camp story. Back in the same era, probably mid to late 80s, Russ Salvatore, the restaurateur, would have a party the night before the Bills-Dolphins game. He still does, I believe. I think there's still a party in Fort Lauderdale. And I went with Van. We went in a cab. The place was packed. It was like Shooters in Fort Lauderdale. And I followed behind Van. You couldn't get in the door. It was so crowded. And yet when Van got there, the seas parted, and he walked through the middle of the crowd, and people were in awe, and I was just following in his wake, and people were reaching out just to touch his garment, the great Van Miller. And I think it sounds like pretty similar to what you described there, Mark. Van and Fredonia, he was a hero down that way. Tom and Tonawanda, welcome. You're on the show. What training camp memories do you have for us tonight, Tom?
Well, I'm going way back here. I feel like I'm 100 years old, but we're going back to the Camelot Motor Inn. Do you remember that, John?
I never went there to camp, but I forgot that. That was a site for a couple of years, right?
I sure was, and my dad, you know, God love him, he passed away in the last year, but he used to take my brother and I down there. He was in the quarterback club, and they'd always have a day down there. And I still have the pictures of Stu Barber, Jack Kemp, Tom Flores, Keith Lincoln, all these guys that would stop. They were just the greatest guys, and they'd sign autographs for us, and we'd go to the luncheon afterwards. We'd watch the practices. It was just the best time.
Yeah, I'm looking it up now in the media guide, 63 through 67. So in the championship years, that's when they were at the Camelot Hotel, which is in Blaisdell.
Years, and then when they started going downhill after that. But still, it was just a great time.
And, Tom, that was it's exit 55, the Blaisdell exit. It's still a motel there, I think, right?
Yeah, it's still there. It's still there. In fact, I tell my nephew, Pete Cargis is my nephew, and my dad was his grandfather, and I used to tell him about that when we'd all go down there and see the players, and it was just such a great time.
Yeah. All right, that's a good one. You know, I never went to training camp there, but I do have memory of training camp being there, and I have a vivid memory of being in a car driving down the thruway and seeing players. You could see it from the thruway, seeing players up on the little rise there next to the motel. That was an NFL training camp, and thinking, can we stop? Can we stop and look? And no such luck. We're probably on our way to Bemis Point or something. Brian in Cheektowaga. Brian, welcome. You're on the air. Your favorite training camp memory, Brian?
Hey, John. My first training camp was Niagara, and we were just mesmerized by J.D. Hill and O.J. Simpson. And we're standing there along that snow fence there, and Lou Saban's walking by. And he says to us, why are you people here? It's too hot. You should be home in a swimming pool. So we got a kick out of that. And then Joe O'Donnell came up to us and started talking to us for a little while. So we got a big charge out of that. And then years later, I followed him to Fredonia, and that was always cool. I remember being there when practice, about an hour after practice, I was still there, and Wade Phillips came sneaking through the snow the fence there to go jogging for a while. So that was cool. And I also have a picture of a young John Murphy from back in those days.
Oh.
You can believe that.
What was I doing? I hope I wasn't doing anything.
No, you were actually walking off the one field after one of the workouts.
Okay.
The guys were all in their golf carts, and unfortunately you weren't riding a golf cart, so I was taking pictures, and I snapped one of you. So
well, the golf carts,
that picture.
The golf carts got out of control at Fredonia to the point where we in the media had to have them, too, to kind of keep up with the players. So, I mean, it was crazy, and they were fast. There was a lot of...
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember they used to sneak around the backside sometimes to avoid the crowd, you know. So I remember taking my nephew. He's about 7 years old, and I don't know who it was. It might have been Kelly or Thurman. He totally disappeared in a crowd of people, and I didn't know where he was.
Yeah.
He comes out like 5 minutes later, all excited, shaking his hand, like, look, I got his autograph. So some cool memories.
That's great. So, thanks, Brian. Yeah, I think there's enough distance removed, so it's not really telling tales out of school, but there was a group of players who not only, rode around in golf carts, they played a lot of golf at training camp in Fredonia over at the Shortwood Country Club on the lake in Dunkirk. And they'd get in 9 holes at lunchtime and 9 holes after the afternoon practice. And you could probably name them if you think about it. They were pretty prominent Buffalo Bills who used the time away at training camp to sharpen up their short game. Who can blame them? I've often thought about this, and this thought will occur to me tomorrow. For any guy, and Jay, I want you to think about this and chime in. For any guy, a chance to go, I mean, you miss your family, you're working hard, there's stress, there's pressure, but for any guy, a chance to go away with guys who are probably your pretty good friends and spend a month away from everybody else and work together and just hang out together to be fed and clothed. I mean, again, the schedule is, it's not a bad deal for a 25-year-old guy, let's say. I'd sign up for that. I mean, the football, notwithstanding. I'd sign up. If somebody said to me when I was 25, hey, do you want to go away with the 85 of your best friends and guys your age and hang out for a month in a hotel and have all expenses paid? You're 25 years old. You'd sign up for that.
Absolutely. And I always say this. Now, a job's a job, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes we get caught in that thought. But if you can go back to when I was a kid, and you're the same, you grew up a Bills fan, to put yourself back then and to say, okay, when I'm an adult, I'm going to be following around a pro football team. I'm going to be traveling with them. I'm going to be covering with them.
Yeah.
My day-to-day life will be involved around them. I wouldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe it. So sometimes you take it for granted. But, yeah, this is great.
You got to pinch yourself. Dan in his car. Dan, welcome. You're on the air. Any training camp memories from you, Dan?
Hey, Murph. How you doing?
Great.
Hey, there's training camp memories. I worked really crazy hours, and back when the Bills were in training in Fredonia, I really couldn't make it to training camp, but Thursday nights was my night to go down to my favorite watering
hole. Uh-oh, okay.
And it was just really cool because you could, be elbow-to-elbow with these guys. Nobody was bothering them for autographs and
right.
stuff. They just were there, and it was just so cool to be next to them, to be around them, and standing next to some of these guys. That's when I realized how really big some of these guys are.
Yeah. And they did they did mix and mingle with the folks in Fredonia. I'm sure there's some of that in Rochester and Pittsburgh as well. But, boy, back then it was like they had friends there. I mean, John Butler, the late John Butler, had friends just from training camp that he would hang with from the Dunkirk-Fredonia area. Ted Cottrell, former defense coordinator, has friends, I believe, to this date from training camp in Dunkirk and Fredonia that they still see and keep in contact with.
The other thing I used to do, I was younger then and was able to go out running every morning, and I used to run up on the campus just to see who might be out and about, and I always saw Marv out jogging in the morning.
Yeah, Fredonia was a great spot. I have very fond memories of training camp in Fredonia, and now it almost seems a different – well, it is. It's a different time, a different era, and I understand how important it is for the for training camp to be in Rochester, and it's a great setup in Rochester, but it was a different era. It was much more – you can get your arms around it more, I think, at Fredonia. It was just kind of more small townish. Doug on his cell phone. Doug, we're talking about your favorite training camp memory. Do you have any, Doug? Hello, Doug. Are you there? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Murph.
Sure.
Great show. Mike,
my son was probably about 12 or 13 at the time, and him and his buddies would go down to the dorms when the players would arrive for training camp to help them unload their luggage. So quick way to make some money.
Yep.
And we also got to meet several of the players, including the greatest guy as far as taking time to autograph with the fans was Joe Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But we also got to meet Andre Reed, Curtis Brown, just downtown establishments when I lived there. So, yeah, we do miss it down in that area. But, yeah, I can understand the move to Rochester makes a lot of sense for the fan base. So,
yeah.
And I'll hang out for your reaction. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Doug. Great memories. Yeah, it does make sense. And it's worked having training camp in Rochester. You know, it's much more accessible to media from both cities, much more accessible to fans. I think there's a demonstrated uptick in season ticket sales in the Rochester area over the 14 or 15 years of the training camp partnership with St. John Fisher. It works down there. And it's a great camp, too, by the way. John in Rochester. John, welcome. How are you?
How are you? Mine's kind of like a two-parter. I worked a lot, so I really didn't make it to camp a ton, but I worked at Wegmans right down the road from training camp,
mm-hmm.
and I was stocking shelves, and I turned around, and there's Doug Flutie, and, I mean, he's not tall, he's about my height, and great guy, very talkative, and he signed a box of Flutie Flakes for me, and just a very good guy. And then I had a night job as well, delivering pizzas, and I would deliver pizzas to the campus a lot, and I remember specifically time that I went and I delivered to Sam Adams. And the guy is huge.
Yeah. Just one pizza at Sam's room?
He ordered everything pizza.
Just one.
And a big guy and a great tipper.
It's great.
I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, John. That's a great story. Yeah. We're collecting training camp memories as we make our way to training camp with our first show there tomorrow night. It is the John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Here's a pizza story. This goes back to Fredonia, too. I can't remember the player. I'm reluctant to name the player because I don't know if I have it right. But I didn't witness this. I heard the story secondhand, but it's a great story. There was a Bills player who they were trying desperately to get to lose weight. You know, they had him on the low-calorie diet in the dining hall at Fredonia, you know, working him out, trying to get him to lose weight. I think a big offensive lineman. And at the time, Rusty Jones was the Bills' strength and conditioning coordinator. He was in charge of that weight loss effort. He discovered that this player would order a pizza virtually every night delivered to his room at Fredonia. So one night, Rusty Jones, doing his job, intercepted the pizza guy and knocked on the player's door. And when the guy came to the door to pay for his pizza and get his pizza, it was Rusty, the strength and conditioning coach, who delivered the pizza to him. Isn't that great? Isn't that a great story?
Oh.
And I think the guy ate his pizza and was probably cut about a week later. Let's go to Butch on the east side. Hello, Butch. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a good memory back in Fredonia, John. I played running back at Bishop Tyman, and then I went to Kensington High School also. But when I was at Tyman, I had a, you know, I had a running back who played with me named Sean Doctor.
Yeah.
And Mike McCarthy and Tony Gasacci, Larry Doc, we had a good time at Bishop Tyman. But anyway, so I always had a dream of playing pro football one time when I was little, but I thought I could go to North Carolina. Gannon University offered me a scholarship, but it was Division II, so I didn't take it. I went to the military instead. But the thing about it is I went to Fredonia with my little guy when Sean got drafted for Marshall by the Buffalo Bills.
Mm-hmm.
And I came down to just to see him and just see the practice. But in the meantime, he saw me out there, and he told me at the end, John, you know how they used to walk from walks to the little you know, the little place where they shower and everything.
Sure.
And a couple pads by the fence. And he allowed me, he told the security guard to let me in. And I went in with Sean, you know, I went in and saw some of the Bills players, and he stopped a lot of the players there in the locker room, and he said, listen, he said, I made it here, but this guy is my friend, and he should be here. And that made me feel good in front of my little son, and I never forget
it.
Every time I see Sean, I always see him. He's doing well, his family's doing well, but, John, that was a good memory.
That's a great story.
Thank you so much,
John. Thanks, Butch. That's a really good story. Mike in Cheektowaga, do you have a training camp memory you want to share?
Oh, John, you're going to love this one. Back in the day, when it was Fredonia, I used to work at Pella, and we had a service tech that would be on the road fixing things all the time.
Well, what'd you say, Pella?
Well,
Pella
he
window?
Qualified for some field goal contest there.
Okay.
So he asked for the day off, and they said, no, you can't. We're too busy. We're swamped. Well, he was out in that kind of area, and he went to the field goal contest. He kicks the ball, hits Kent Holt in the butt. They televised it, you know, later on in the news, yeah. He got fired like 2-3 days later.
Oh, man. So he didn't get the Bills job and he lost the other job.
Yeah, there
you are. Oh, that's great.
Kent Hall's butt got him fired.
Thanks for your show, thanks, man.
Mike.
I love it.
Thanks for calling. Tom in Buffalo. Hi, Tom. Welcome. You have a training camp story for us.
Yeah, this was back in the Fredonia days, and I worked at the cafeteria at Fredonia during training camp. And it was after breakfast. The place had cleared out. The Bills had all gone. And I'm sitting there reading an article in the Buffalo News about Jim Haslett. And I noticed somebody reading over my shoulder. So I turned around kind of indignantly looking at, who was this rude person reading over my shoulder? And it was Haslett himself reading over my shoulder.
Yeah. How did he handle it? Was he okay? Was Haz okay with it?
He just kind of walked away.
That's great. That's great. Tom, thanks for the call. You know, it strikes me, all these calls we've taken, some with Rochester story, some Fredonia, some Niagara, some the place in Blaisdell, the Camelot Inn. It almost, the common theme is the closeness that the fans get with these players at training camp. The personal interaction, whether it's an autograph through the snow fence or working in the cafeteria or delivering pizzas or participating in a field goal contest that went awry. That's the great thing about the training camp. That's what will happen starting Sunday anyway, when practice starts down at St. John Fisher. The players are right there. The fans are right there. There's autographs. There's interaction. You don't get that a lot in many professional sports these days. There's not a whole lot of things like that in professional sports these days. And it's free. Did I mention it's free? Nobody's selling you a ticket to have that sort of interaction. It's not like you're going to a card show or an autograph show. It's free, and you're right there. And, by the way, if you're into the game, you're watching practice. It's a great thing. Can you, every night we do the show this week, Jay, I've been a little more excited about training camp. And does that come across? I mean, you know, we're getting ready. We're packing up stuff today. But every night this week when I've done the show, I thought, yeah, I like that about training camp. I like this about training camp.
It's the start of a new season. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited, too. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to get into a little football when we return, a little analytics. Gordon McInnes is an analyst and writer for ProFootballFocus.com, and he's done a pretty extensive study of what he calls quarterback progression and how much better does a quarterback get from his first year to his second, especially first-round draft picks. Obviously, E.J. Manuel fits into that category. We'll talk with Gordon McInnes about Manuel and quarterback progression, what it means for him to be in his second year when we return. Thanks for calling in. We'll try to get some more calls on later on in the show. The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO. Live tonight at One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, with the Bills headed off to training camp tomorrow. They'll report tomorrow. The first practice is on Sunday. And as we've said for the last several months, really since last season ended, all eyes will be on quarterback E.J. Manuel. What can we expect from E.J. Manuel in his second year? We can talk about it all night. The folks at Pro Football Focus have done a study based on football analytics about progression of quarterbacks from the first year to the second year. And the author of the position progression on quarterbacks, Gordon McInnes, is on the line with us now from his home in Scotland. Gordon, thank you very much for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about how this works, position progression, and in general, before we talk about the quarterbacks, what the folks at PFF do when they look at these numbers from year to year.
Yeah, so essentially what we're doing with the position progression pieces is we're just taking the grades that are accumulated from us watching and breaking down every play, and we're just seeing how quarterbacks, or every position throughout the league, has developed from years 1 to 5. And just seeing if there's a general trend, if there's a trend that tells you certain quarterbacks are going to have more success than others.
How do quarterbacks in general compare to other position groups? Do other position groups improve more rapidly than quarterbacks from first year to second year?
Yeah, there's quarterbacks generally from, we're looking at first-round quarterbacks when I did the study, there wasn't a massive jump from year 1 to 2. It seemed to be year 1, the average rookie quarterback had like a slight negative grade, and that just jumped up to a slight positive grade in the second year. The other positions, offensive linemen, a fair few of them actually graded out quite well as rookies. So it's definitely a little bit different for quarterbacks.
Well, it's there's always eyes on quarterbacks, too. And we knew this right from a year ago when E.J. Manuel was drafted in the first round. You're right about it, too. When it comes to quarterbacks in the NFL, everybody expects the rookie to step in and play well right away. That's rare, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think recently people have expected it more. And I think that's just because as rookies, you saw Andrew Luck, Russell Wilson, Ryan Tannehill to a lesser extent, and RG3 have really big rookie years. So I think that almost made people over the last couple of years think that, rookies are going to be fine now. They can just step in. And I think it's dangerous to look at that because that's more a case of that was four good young quarterbacks that just had really good first years.
Yeah. I want to revisit that in a second, Gordon, but when I read through your article, the one thing that stuck to me, one of the things that stuck with me was that it's not just quarterbacks. There are really no position where rookies are projected to perform better than the league average. I mean, that's why they're rookies. It takes a while to get used to the league, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And you imagine they're coming from playing in college where they're playing against the vast majority of players who will never play football again, and all of a sudden they're going up against some of the best athletes in the world, so... And you imagine if you're a guard coming out of college and all of a sudden you're going up against someone like J.J. Watt, the difference is immense.
And then when it comes to quarterbacks, though, because they are the focal point of so much attention, when they're drafted in the first round, not only are they expected to play right away, for the most part, the expectation is for them to play well right away. That's difficult for them, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think because of how important the position is, everyone's under a microscope and every mistake gets magnified, so everyone almost blows every mistake out of proportion, where a rookie quarterback comes in, he's going to make mistakes, and I think people need to expect that.
We're on the line with Gordon McGinnis. He's one of the analytics guys from ProFootballFocus.com. He's done a position progression about quarterbacks. And when we talk about progression, we talk about the second year. So tell me what your study has shown as far as quarterbacks from year one to their second year in the league. In general, what does that look like?
So in general, there's a slight improvement from year one to two. As I said a little bit before there, it's just a very small negative in year one and then a slight positive in year two. There's some quarterbacks over the years that have had strong second years. Again, the young guys we spoke about last year. And then obviously Matt Ryan actually had a big drop from his rookie grade down to second year, but was still a positive guy. So I think you can probably expect a slight improvement from rookie quarterbacks in their second year, just as they become a little bit more comfortable. But it's not as if they're all of a sudden the best quarterbacks in the league.
2012, did that skew things with Luck and RG3 and even Russell Wilson? Did that skew the quarterback ratings from year one to year two, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a good chance of that. The flip side to that, I suppose, is that you had a guy like Blaine Gabbert in his very first year grade at minus 47. So that kind of skews it the other way. But the guys like Matt Ryan and then Tannehill, Luck, Russell Wilson, and RG3, that definitely wasn't the norm from what we saw before.
Gordon, tell us, it's important, I think, at this point for you to tell us how the Pro Football Focus grades are assigned. And maybe you can start with E.J. Manuel's grade and how you and your analytics partners there at Pro Football Focus reached that grade for E.J. Manuel's rookie year.
Yeah, so E.J. Manuel graded out at minus 18.1 in his rookie year, which was the second worst of all starting quarterbacks in the NFL. What we're doing basically is we look at every single play, and when it comes to quarterbacks, we're giving them a positive play, a positive grade for a positive throw. So that's a throw that goes beyond the markers for a first down, touchdown. They would get a positive grade if they throw the ball and it should be caught but it's dropped. We wouldn't downgrade a quarterback for the receiver making a mistake. And then negative obviously come from throws that should be intercepted, underthrows on deep balls and things like that.
Minus 18 for E.J. Manuel. He finished ahead of who in the quarterback grades?
Chad Henne and Jacksonville was the only one he finished ahead
okay.
of.
Okay. Now, is there anything you've done in your study of the analytics that would indicate what E.J.'s grade might be, in a second year in the league? Based on your study, we can expect some improvement, right?
Yeah, I think you can probably expect some improvement. And the other thing with E.J. Manuel's grade in his rookie year, while it was minus 18.1, we know he was hurt a little bit, mm-hmm. and he also had two really poor games. So the game against the Jets in week 3 and the game against Atlanta in week 13, that wound up being minus 11.3. So that took up the vast majority of his negative grade just from two really poor games.
Mm-hmm.
There was a a couple of positively graded games in there and a couple of games that were quite average. So I think if anyone wants to look for the positives for a jump from year one to two, we saw Matthew Stafford back in his rookie season. He graded at minus 30.8 and then took a big jump to a slight positive the next year when he only played a limited amount of snaps. But in his next full season as a starter, was back at plus 12.4. So he's a guy that took a big step forward. And when we looked at the best-case scenario for drafting a rookie quarterback, the worst-case scenario, Stafford was the kind of middle ground in that. So while there's concerns about how Manuel played at points in his rookie year, there's definitely encouraging signs. And you could look at a guy like Stafford and say a poor rookie season doesn't define him.
I'm trying to think what may have changed for Matthew Stafford in those couple of years. I know one thing, his quarterback coach for the Lions is now E.J. Manuel's quarterback coach. That bodes well, I would think, for E.J. Manuel.
Yeah, things like that are always going to help, and especially having a guy that was there for Stafford's improvement, that's something that can only help mentally for E.J. Manuel.
You talked about how Stafford is sort of the middle ground for quarterback improvement from one year to the next. You also, in your article, write about the best-case scenario. What's the most dramatic improvement for a quarterback from his rookie year to his second year?
So in the article, we kind of looked at the best-case scenario for a quarterback in round one, and Matt Ryan was a guy who started out fast. If you're looking for a guy who improved from year one to year two, Stafford's probably the best example of that again, just because there was a nice big jump. You also had Joe Flacco have a nice jump. He was a slight negative grade in his rookie year and then jumped up to plus 21.2. But it depends how much you want your quarterback to be compared to Joe Flacco, because while he's won a Super Bowl, his play has been very up and down through the years as well.
How about worst-case scenario?
The worst-case scenario, it's a toss-up. You can take your pick out of Blaine Gabbert and Jamarcus Russell.
Oh, boy.
I don't think anyone wants either of that, but that's guys who came in, started out in the rookie years and performed poorly pretty much until the time was done as a starter. So.
Yeah. Well, Gordon, you've done the analytics, you've done the grading, you know what we're dealing with here with E.J. Manuel. I wonder if you can divorce yourself from the strictly analytics viewpoint. What's your thoughts on E.J. Manuel, and how realistic is it for Buffalo Bills fans who expect that they may see some dramatic improvement from him based on what you've done with the numbers and just based on your observations?
I think when I saw him last year, I didn't think he was a completely terrible quarterback. I think it was hard to judge because he obviously struggled with injuries at points, and it was kind of stop-start with him playing. But I definitely think there's a chance that in year two he can be an average quarterback, and I don't think he's going to be in the league anywhere, but I would expect an improvement from his rookie grade.
And average quarterbacks can win. They can take teams to the playoffs. That's been demonstrated.
Yeah, absolutely. And even a guy like Joe Flacco, I think in today's NFL, while teams are always looking for a quarterback like a Peyton Manning or a Matt Ryan who's going to be good throughout the year, if you can get a quarterback that can get hot for 5-6 games, that's something all it takes to win a Super Bowl. So.
Yeah. Well, Gordon, thanks for talking with us about this tonight. I'm continue to be amazed by the output of you and your colleagues at Pro Football Focus. We were talking with Steve Palazzolo about this a month or so ago. Just because the 2013 season ends, it's almost like you guys go to work during the offseason analyzing what all the video that you have. That eventually you'll turn your attention to 2014, I would think, huh?
Yeah, so we're not too far away from that now. We just got finished up with we went back and graded 2007, so we got finished up with that a few weeks ago. So now it's kind of looking ahead and getting ourselves ready for the preseason starting in a couple of weeks.
Well, it's a great tool to have. We advise our listeners, if you're interested in applying analytics to the Bills or the rest of the NFL, profootballfocus.com. They have great sets of numbers to look at to analyze what you're seeing. Gordon, thank you very much for being with us tonight. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Gordon McGinnis is a writer, researcher for ProFootballFocus.com. He's done a position progression of quarterbacks, in particular first-round quarterbacks, which indicate that first year to second year, there should be some pretty substantial improvement from a quarterback from year to year, which bodes well, I would think, for the Bills' E.J. Manuel. Our thanks to Gordon McGinnis of ProFootballFocus.com. It is the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO from One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Gordon McGinnis from ProFootballFocus.com. Highly recommend that website for analytics. And they've done an exhaustive study of every position, really. Gordon focused on the quarterbacks, and I thought his comments on second-year quarterbacks, first-rounders in particular, applies a lot to E.J. Manuel. There's more on E.J. Manuel on our website. Chris Brown, as part of his questions headed into training camp, today he has written about three ways E.J. Manuel can be a difference maker, trusting what he sees, number one, and he has, Chris, talked to Nathaniel Hackett about that. Completion percentage, EJ last year, completion percentage, was it 58%, which is less than what you need. You need to get up above 60, maybe as much as 63, 65%. And then clutch plays. EJ had a couple of clutch plays. The Bills need more. Did you know EJ Manuel's passer rating in the final four games was 92.1, his completion percentage almost 76%. Those are good signs as far as clutch plays, clutch time. But read Chris Brown's report on EJ Manuel, three ways he can improve his game this upcoming season. All right, coming up next hour, we're going to talk about the training camp and talk about lecturing players about locker room culture. Chris Draft, former Bills linebacker, will join us live. He's going to handle that discussion on behalf of the NFL, one of their ambassadors at training camp this year. And we'll talk with him about that when we return. Another hour to go. The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. We're at One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Is over. We're back with more of the John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO.
You can't stop CJ Spiller. You can't stop him. How did he do it? How did he do it?
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO, supplying natural gas and electricity to thousands of homes and businesses across Western New York.
Everybody's on their feet in the stands.
This crowd is absolutely whipped into a frenzy.
The John Murphy Show, presented by NOCO on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Hour two of the show begins. I keep looking around the studio and thinking, what do I got to bring to St. John Fisher? What do I need for training camp? Got a box of stuff, and it's just stuff. I probably won't even need any of it. Our final show in Orchard Park for a while, although from time to time over the next 4 or 5 weeks, we'll be doing shows here when the Bills are off down in Rochester at training camp. The Bills moving down there now, and the players will be reporting there tomorrow. Get settled in for a couple of days before they hit the practice field on Sunday night, 6 o'clock practice at Grounding Stadium, St. John Fisher College. Part of that settling in process is involvement in the NFL's effort to change locker room culture. It's part of the NFL Player Engagement Department's effort to educate players on the right locker room culture. They have a number of ambassadors, most of them former NFL players who conduct these seminars for NFL players. The Bills is coming up this weekend, and one of the ambassadors who will be there is a former Buffalo Bill. He played for 7 teams over 12 years. He played for the Buffalo Bills in 2009. Linebacker Chris Draft, now an NFL ambassador, and he joins us live on the line right now. Chris, good evening. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
How did you get tapped to be one of these NFL ambassadors?
I think I was a squeaky wheel when I was playing. It was talking about all the improvements that could happen, and also really just the tremendous opportunity of playing in this league. And I was disappointed at times that our guys weren't reminded about, you know, what they could do in impacting their community enough. And I think I said that enough that when I was done, that Commissioner Goodell said, we got to have you doing something up here at all.
You know, it seems to me this has all had renewed emphasis, not just because of the Miami incident last year. We'll talk about that. But Troy Vincent and, in fact, even Kim Fields, who we had on the show here a couple of months ago, they've done a pretty good job of pushing this to the forefront and making sure that players get the kind of education you're talking about.
Absolutely. We're just in a different world. We're in a different world. And, you know, too often, and, you know, just, you know, football's been kind of a sport where the locker room is the locker room. I mean, you've heard the sayings, what's said here, what's done here stays here. Well, it's not exactly just staying there. And then that really is not all encompassing. So if it's something that is, you know, that's not respectful, that is a little bit off the reservation, it's not about just holding it inside. It's about saying that we need to deal with it. And I think that's what this program is about, is just saying that these guys are men. You know, we're men that are playing this game, and we should treat each other accordingly.
Hey, Chris, you said something a moment ago about how it's a different world now, and you've been out of the NFL as a player for 5 years. Is it even different over these last 5 years when it was when you left the game?
It's absolutely different. I think when you have the social media has drastically changed it, along with the types of phones. You know, I was trying to hold on to a flip phone. I was holding on to a little slide phone where you could do some text messaging. But now it's just amazing how much you can do with social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you know, the ability to record people with video. It just makes it where your actions, they can be seen by so many people. So it's important that we're more authentic. I mean, that there's not just the persona for the public, but really that you're living that, which is, you know, ideal anyway.
Chris Dreft, our guest, former linebacker in the NFL, a stint with the Bills in 2009, now an NFL ambassador for the player engagement. So, Chris, give us you've done a couple of these before. You're not. This isn't your first one this weekend in Buffalo, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I actually spoke to Chicago Bears a couple of weeks ago.
Give us an example of what that discussion is like, how long it is, and who will be talking to the players in this event.
Well, maybe it'll be about 45 minutes to an hour. And the key is to just have a discussion about the issues that are coming up. And I know, you know, you talked about Richie in terms of hazing. We have to address that. We have to address the issues regarding having Michael Sams playing right now as an Oakland A player. We have to talk about issues in terms of the N-word, where right now there's potential of getting fined for using that word. So we have to talk about those things along with some other things that are a little bit more that are kind of these buzz issues in the NFL. And instead of just putting down rules that really challenge you to have respect by regulating it, but really having a discussion and saying, you know, where we can come to a consensus that it's the right thing to do.
You know,
that's your teammate.
Yeah.
And that we need to take care of our teammate.
Some might say, old school people might say, Chris, hey, that's the coach's job to tell them what's white, what's right, what's wrong, what's acceptable. Not so.
Mm-hmm. I think some old school people will say that they really will. But I think again, having a discussion is not about just saying just right and wrong and kind of going out there and saying black and white, but really saying, you know, really kind of coming to a consensus together that it's the right thing to do. That having respect of men is the ultimate on a team anyway. It, you know, the game of football is about respect and trust. And so when you have a teammate that doesn't feel comfortable, and then, again, the other side is our ultimate goal is winning. So if a teammate doesn't feel comfortable, they don't feel like they're, you know, they're accepted, are you going to get the best out of them? And if our ultimate goal is winning, you know, we want the best out of everyone on that team.
Chris Dreft is our guest. He's going to be talking to the Buffalo Bills players at training camp this weekend about locker room culture, part of the NFL player engagement. I wonder, Chris, do you look for, like, leaders? And, you know, as you said, you got 45 minutes or an hour, but mm-hmm. is it important to reach captains or leaders in order to change locker room culture?
Absolutely. I mean, the leaders, you know, from year to year, I know you've been around for a long time, they can drastically change what the culture is. I mean, you know, the culture of the Bills with a guy like Jim Kelly and Thurman Thomas and Bruce Smith, Cornelius Bennett, Darrell Talley. I mean, that's a different locker room than the locker room now. It doesn't say it's just so much better, but at the same time, it's different. And I think it's important that the leaders really set the tone. So we're going to have some time prior to the main meeting to sit down with some of the guys, and their buy-in is essential to really, again, understanding this is something that is necessary from an NFL level, but really more necessary because, again, we want to get the most out of our players.
Do you find that the player buy-in is pretty good in the events you've had so far and the lectures you've had so far on player engagement?
Absolutely. I mean, some people are, you know, initially they're, you know, they have their opinions about what they think on certain issues. But after you have a little bit more of a conversation and you realize at the end of the day is that if someone's feeling uncomfortable, if there's just issues in that locker room, more than anything, you have a chance to lose. And I think case in point, when you look at Richie Incognito and everything that went down with him and Jonathan Martin, it was terrible what happened, and the words and text messages that came out were horrible. But really, what was lost in it was the Jonathan Martin that they had traded for a guy the week before he had left, and really the pressures of football to be able to perform. And so what was lost was that, and then what was lost was games afterwards because the team was completely distracted and just you know, out of sorts until those things could get resolved. And so, I think our team is, you know, we want to address it because it's the right thing to do, but then as a team, you want to address it because there's no need for those distractions.
You spent a dozen years in the league as a player, Chris. Did the revelations of the Jonathan Martin, Richie Incognito incident, did they surprise you?
It surprised me in that, you know, not as much because I know Richie. He can be a little bit crazy. But at the same time, what was really, I think, was really disappointing was there really was not enough discussion about just how difficult it is to play in this game. And Jonathan was struggling on the field, and there was nothing to really talk about, just the pressure of being able to play and how, you know, when it's your dream and you get there and you don't feel like you're performing, that it's not just bullying that's going to push you over, but that bullying could be on top of something that's a lot bigger.
Chris Draft is our guest. He's a former Bills linebacker, a 12-year NFL veteran. He'll be speaking to the Bills at training camp about locker room culture coming up this weekend at St. John Fisher College. On the Incognito issue, Chris, it struck me, and I think I asked this question of Kim Fields a couple of months ago, How important is it for coaches to be engaged? And, you know, many coaches will tell you, oh, the locker room is their sanctuary. I'm not going to interfere. Would these situations be helped by coaches maybe spending more time around the player locker room?
You know, absolutely. I think what's important is that it's not just the players' locker room. Again, definitely it's their locker room, but it's an organization. It's part of that organization. I think as we talk about not just the locker room culture and changing that, but really just expanding just what the workplace looks like and in where you're expected to be met. And so that's from a locker room to throughout the organization and out in the community. So we're holding people really just to a higher standard, and I think definitely that comes from the top down in terms of ownership, management, and coaching staff that says, hey, we're not, you know, we don't just want football players, we want men.
And it's important, I guess. I mean, you don't think you'll walk out of the Buffalo team meeting room down in Rochester this weekend and the culture will change, right? It could take time. It could take years.
Well, it's always a process. I mean, anything that happens can, you know, something good, something bad can affect that locker room. So what's important is more that there's just a commitment to what kind of locker room they want, and you're either there or you're getting there, or you're there and you have to maintain it. So it's not something that you decide on one day and you've arrived, but it's something that, just like with football, that we have to constantly work at.
Chris, I want to ask you a couple of questions about your tenure here in Buffalo. 2009 season, they brought you in, I think, after Kavika Mitchell got hurt about 4 or 5 weeks into the season, and you finished up the rest of that year. Started a few games in 2009.
Yes.
What do you recall about the year?
I tell you, I love playing in Buffalo. I mean, it's just nothing like the energy of Ralph Wilson Stadium and a community that just lives and dies football. I mean, just a tremendous community. I mean, my favorite memories of that year is really when we beat the Miami Dolphins, and just hearing everyone say, you know, letting the song play, let the Buffalo Bills make you wanna, you know, and just have it all over the place, man. Just so much energy, so much passion, and it just felt great to win in a place like that and absolutely uplift the community.
It was a 6-win season for the Bills, and you were here for the coaching change, right, when Perry Fuel replaced Dick Geron?
Yes.
How was that to adjust to?
Unfortunately, I've had some coaching changes throughout my career, but Perry was great. I mean, it was a very smooth transition. It's just as hard. I mean, any time that happens, for the most part, you're going to struggle with it during the season. And, there were some injuries that really did work hand in hand with everything else that was going on too. But the guys, they stayed together and they kept on fighting. And that's really what you want. And you can see some of those core guys that are still around. But as long as they keep on fighting, man, that's what you want, because then we can keep moving into the next year.
You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you what the locker room culture was like in that year for the Bills. As I said, it was a 6-win season, but what was it like around the Buffalo Bills that year you were here?
Yeah, I mean, we had a great group. I mean, there's definitely some guys that kind of struggled I wouldn't say more with kind of a locker room culture, but just really struggled with a little bit of adjustment. I mean, a guy like Aaron Maven, who was kind of struggling with being in Buffalo and other guys. I think with Buffalo, it's not as much of kind of a locker room culture as much as just an adjustment just to being in Buffalo that the guys have to deal with. And that's really what the player engagement department is about with the NFL, is really meeting the players where they're at, not just having blanket programs or development programs, but really asking each individual, what are your issues? One team it might be a little bit more of the locker room, another one it's just more of transitioning and understanding how to drive in the snow.
You mentioned Aaron Maben. I believe that was his rookie year, right? His first year with the Bills.
Yes.
What do you think? I don't want you to trash the guy, but what do you think it was about him that that he didn't have more success in the league? Was there something about his personal makeup, or is it just an ability question? What do you make of that a couple years removed?
I think it was a little bit hard for him to transition. After having a great year, he had a lot of people that told him how great he was. And probably one of the best things that you can do is be humble when you come into the game, and then also really understand where you stand. I knew that throughout my career, and that meant that I was always on the borderline between being on my way out versus in.
Yeah.
So I was, whatever you needed to do, coach. And I think, he got that a little bit as he moved to another, some of the other teams. But if he'd had a little bit more of that mindset, that would have helped him out. That says, hey, man, whatever you need me to do, coach, and really being more, real very coachable and saying, hey, what can I do? How can I? And we got a great group of D linemen. How can I look at what you're doing and learn from it?
Hey, Chris, we've talked to you a lot tonight about locker room culture, but you've hinted at outside the locker room culture. And, boy, it's hard to find anyone who's done a better job at that in the community than you. Tell me about the Chris Draft Family Foundation.
Well, our mission is to empower families to live healthy lifestyles. And it was inspired by two people that had cancer that, I taught special ed kids in high school. One of my teachers, who actually was diagnosed with lung cancer about 2 years after I left high school and passed about a year and a half later, and a high school coach of mine that had melanoma actually just passed a couple of years, a couple of weeks ago. But, the inspiration was the cancer gives you a sense of urgency, and how, what would people need to have in their lives if cancer came in, in terms of the strength of physical strength, of mental strength, emotional strength, and then financial strength. And so that's what this foundation was based on, and until we added an addition, and that addition was Team Draft. And Team Draft was inspired by my wife. My wife, who absolutely loved coming to Buffalo. She was there in 2009. She was cheering. She was bundled up. She was having a ball while we were up there. And unfortunately was diagnosed with lung cancer in December of 2010. The great thing was that I was done. I was done so I could be with her at that time. Absolutely horrible, horrible diagnosis, but stage 4 lung cancer. She was never smoker, amazing shape, challenged me to do P90X and run a 10K with her, and out of nowhere, lung cancer.
Wow.
And so serious that, just put up an amazing fight. Amazing ability to smile each day and continue just thinking about other people. But after a year, and pretty much a year from her diagnosis, she passed December 27th, 2011. And we've been leading a national campaign to change the face of lung cancer since then. I've been to over 130 cancer centers across the country. I've spoken numerous places, and really what we've done is said, we're going to put the survivors out in front and allow them to share their stories and build the compassion for this disease. My wife's amazing, and she was just energy and love and all that, and that's what we want people to see with our survivors, and so that they can understand why this is important and why we need to get more research so that we can save more lives.
I remember the story, Chris, and it's a tragic, heartbreaking story. My heart goes out to you, and the one thing that stuck with me, your wife, and you mentioned it, your wife never smoked, and I think that's part of the message, right? Anyone can get lung cancer.
Yeah. anyone can, man. It's crazy, man. I never smoked, and just like I said, she's an amazing lady.
Chris.
Amazing lady, and there's so many other folks that are very similar to her, and that's what we try to make sure, that this is not just a bad luck thing where it was my wife, but really that there are too many other folks that are getting that same disease with not enough treatment to be able to handle it, and that's why research is important.
Chris, how much does that tragic story, the story of your life, inform the type of things you talk to NFL players about in the player engagement meetings?
It affects it so much. I think I was prepared of sorts for what happened with my wife because football. I played on seven teams, man. I didn't know if I was coming or going, so I always had to make the best of every situation. Football tells you it's not for long, and you really just can't count on it. And so you need to make the most of the situation and where you're at, and hopefully make a great impact on the people around you. I think that's really a lot of this message, is to not be so selfish that you have to hold on to kind of the children's game, but to really be men and love this game. Love it and respect it enough to do your best, and know that to do your best, you need great teammates. And so take advantage of each of these days. Love these days. Love the days of training camp, even though it can be hot and it can be a little tough, but love it, because it'll be over in 2 seconds.
That's a great message, Chris, and I can't think of a better spokesman for that message than you. Now, I'm doing the math here. You're only 5 years removed from your playing career. You're going to wind up at Bills camp right before they hit the field for the first time. They just signed a linebacker yesterday. What about it? How about a comeback? Have you given that any thought?
Man, I tell you, I was on the field the other day, running around with some high school kids, and my toes started getting a little bit sore, my back started getting a little bit sore, and I was like, man, no. But I don't think a comeback is in my future. I think the time was right when I finished up. But man, I really have to say that I absolutely enjoyed my time in Buffalo, and definitely was not in my plan. What is my plan? So it was an awesome time. I mean, really, really love the people. The Bills fans are tremendous, and everyone should have a chance to experience going and playing in that stadium.
Well, we loved having you here, Chris, and love talking to you either tonight. We'll make a point of reaching out and saying hi to you down at camp this weekend. Thanks very much for doing this.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story with us. Chris Draft played linebacker for seven different teams, as he said, in the NFL over a dozen years. 2009 with the Buffalo Bills. They signed him when Kavika Mitchell got hurt. Remember the horrible 6-3 loss to the Cleveland Browns in the 2009 season? Kavika Mitchell got hurt, and they signed Chris Draft the next day, and he played. He started a few games down the stretch there for the 2009 Buffalo Bills. Not a great season, but certainly some momentous events with Dick Duran's dismissal and Perry Fuel taking over. And as Chris pointed out, the big win, I think it was like 31-14, big win over the Dolphins. I believe it was Thanksgiving weekend that year. What a story. What a great story, and what a great guy to tell the story, Chris Draft. I would imagine that his speech, along with the other NFL ambassadors this weekend to Bills players, I would imagine there's going to be a lot of emotion in that, and probably some a pretty attentive Buffalo Bills players to listen to Chris Draft's story about his career, about locker room culture, and about his story. Amazing. Thanks to him for joining us tonight. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about the NFL in the future, what technology might mean in the National Football League moving forward. So we've got more to come. The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Tonight, live at One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
We're back with more of the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Be at training camp tomorrow night with the show. Doug Whaley, Bills general manager, will be joining us live 7:30 tomorrow. So look forward to that. We'll get you all the news from report day. The players don't hit the field until Sunday night, but we'll be there when players check in around early to mid-afternoon throughout the day. And first day at St. John Fisher College. We'll work out the kinks in our radio setup and be right back there next Monday. Can you believe it? Bills training camp starts tomorrow. We'll be there with the show. We're always kind of keeping an eye on technology and how technology is applied to pro football, NFL football, and the league is pretty proactive when it comes to embracing technology. There was an article that caught my eye in Adweek recently that talks about wearables, things that players would wear that could change the way we view the game. The author joins us now, a reporter for Adweek, Lauren Johnson. Lauren, thank you very much for being on the air with us tonight.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate talking to us about this. And you got to help me, walk me through this a little bit, because I'm not a marketing whiz here. You talk about second screen advertising. What do you mean by that? What's involved there?
So basically, the NFL is involved different initiatives where marketers, they obviously sell ads to, whether it's during, an on-air game or online, want to, the whole premise of second screen advertising is that they want to be able to do more with the TV spot than they have in the past. So they want to drive people online. They want to do just something more to get more out of the traditional pretty hefty TV budgets that marketers have always had. And with more viewers going online, that's the audience they want to reach. And so that's kind of the premise of what the NFL and other sports organizations do when it comes to second screen advertising.
So you had an interview with the league's chief information officer, Michelle McKenna Doyle, and she talked about this and maybe how second screen advertising, second screen marketing might take place based on the things that players wear. Explain to me what she's thinking.
They're thinking of a lot of things, I think, and I was really surprised, actually, at the scope that they are thinking about it, because I don't think some of the other sports leagues are really on the same kind of level that they are. So they're thinking of everything it can be from a consumer standpoint, meaning you're in a stadium and you're connected to a great Wi-Fi connection and you're able to stream the game actually from a smartphone or tablet in the stadiums to, in my opinion, some pretty high-tech stuff going on in the field. So a player might have a technology-enabled shoulder pad where there's a chip actually in the player's actual uniform that's tracking the performance, it's tracking stats on them, and so then obviously a coach or someone can kind of monitor their performance and improve it.
Mm-hmm.
Even some other stuff where the referee has a tech gadget hooked up to a headset that they're able to communicate to NFL's headquarters in New York to review plays and that kind of thing. So it does seem like they've got a lot going on that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, a lot of us are familiar with Google Glass. Talk about that and how that might be applied. You dealt with that in the article, how that sort of technology might be applied to actually the players on the field, huh?
Yeah, I think, Google Glass certainly has some big opportunities in sports marketing, so a player or an athlete could potentially be getting served all this different bits of information that maybe a coach is giving them on the sidelines on how to run a play, what they should be doing next, any kind of information is in front of them. I think the main challenge and why you're not seeing it really go mainstream yet is that is obviously a pretty big distraction for any player on the field, though.
Yeah.
A concern.
I mean, I've heard and read about scenarios where instead of calling in a play or signaling in a play or using a radio to signal in a play, they could actually, outfit players with Google Glass and the play could be diagrammed right in front of them, right, so they can look at it before they run the play. That doesn't sound like that could be that far off, that sort of technology.
No, I don't think so. I think, I think all that is whether it's a Google Glass or an alternative type of wearable, it seems like that's kind of stuff will be coming up in the next couple of years.
Do you think the league, based on your conversations with Michelle McKenna Doyle of the league, the chief information officer for the NFL, Lauren, do you think the league is looking at this technology as a way to improve the, the actual playing of the game, or are they more geared towards marketing the game, selling the game, finding new things to sell?
I think it's both. I think some of the in-stadium stuff is obviously geared towards improving the game itself. If you can have another set of eyes, with the example of the referee, the whole idea is you have another set of eyes reviewing plays, which is going to, benefit any kind of fan as well as, any kind of coach or player wants that extra set of eyes to make sure that everything's fair. But also, it's a big opportunity from them from the marketing perspective because the TV marketing is dropping off as far as an effective way for marketers. I mean, the past Super Bowl, a 30-second spot ran marketers, $4 million, which isn't an increase year over year, but you have more people turning in to smartphones and tablets to watch games. So it's not that TV viewership is necessarily dropping off that significantly. It's just people are watching in different ways. And so a TV marketer and an advertiser isn't necessarily as happy about that pure great brand that they've always had on TV when they can be doing more with it and make digital components to it a little bit more actionable for consumers.
Lauren, is it your sense that the league move slowly on this? And I ask this because when you mentioned the officiating, the fact that they're going to have the on-field referee consult with the league office in New York to look at replay reviews, that's a pretty incremental step, like a small incremental step towards using technology to help officiating. Does the NFL move slowly in this regard, or are they further ahead than other leagues, do you think?
I think they're fairly far ahead. I think if you were to look at some of the other leagues, like NHL or the NBA, it's all pretty much on a, you know, on a similar kind of level. I think the problem for a lot of the leagues and why it may appear that some of these initiatives are might be a little bit slower to take it off is because they do have a massive reach. You know, they've got obviously a ton of different teams and stadiums throughout the nation. That it's one thing to test, you know, one thing at a specific team in, you know, New England versus rolling it out nationally. So it's difficult to kind of scale is, I think, one of the main issues for a lot of the teams.
Do you think, I don't know, if do other leagues pay attention to technology as closely as the NFL does, in your opinion?
I think other sports do. I think there's a big emphasis for a lot of the teams more on the consumer-facing aspect of it, so like a second screen app, a companion app, more of those things that the teams can actually offer to a fan to help them stay engaged. I think for any kind of on-field, like technology-enabled shoulder pads, any of that is pretty ahead of the curve, really.
And it strikes me, Lauren, that as much as we can talk about what might be available technology-wise for the NFL in the years ahead, we probably can't even imagine where this could go. I mean, 5-10 years out, who knows what the NFL would look like or how the presentation of the NFL would look.
Right. And I think you're seeing more. I mean, it could be in the form the whole, what a lot of sports organizations, in my opinion, just talking to a lot of the leagues and that kind of thing, is that, you know, the body is really going to be the big thing. And it's not totally clear about which part of the body the technology is going to live on. It could be something actually embedded into the clothing. There's the example of it in the shoulder pad. It could be something strapped to your wrist. It could be a Google Glass type thing. So they're just experimenting with a lot because there isn't really like a proven way of, you know, this type of technology and this particular place on the body is going to be effective for us.
That's wearables. And what use would be something in your uniform or a chip embedded into your shoulder pads?
Well, the clothing is just to track, you know, your performance.
Mm-hmm.
And just to make, I mean, brands like Nike already kind of experimenting in that place, which McKenna Doyle actually said that they're looking at that type of technology as well, just because they obviously work with brands like Nike to create the actual uniforms themselves. So they're looking at ways that Nike is making the clothing more breathable. Nike is doing just different types of technology to embed the actual clothing itself to be more appealing for the actual athletes themselves.
Yeah. Well, it's come a long way from 3 yards in a cloud of dust in Canton, Ohio, guys, you know, mercenaries playing for $15 a game. Who knows where it'll be in a couple of years. I really enjoyed the article, Lauren, and we thank you very much for coming on the air tonight and talking about it.
Thank you for having me.
Lauren Johnson is a reporter for Adweek, and she did an interview with the NFL's chief information officer, Michelle McKenna Doyle, about about all of this technology and what lies ahead for the league when it comes to marketing technology, using technology, second screen advertising, wearables, stuff you can put in helmets and in uniforms, ways that technology could help aid officiating, Google Glass. I mean, that'd be a great way to watch a replay, wouldn't it, to use Google Glass to watch exactly what a quarterback sees? I mean, you know, they have GoPro cameras and cameras that they can put out. You know, the one innovation that kind of takes place now in the NFL is that camera that hangs over the field that gives you sort of the overview and kind of from the back of the huddle. I mean, think about what can be done probably in the very near future with Google Glass or some sort of embedded camera that can give you the quarterback's eye view or what exactly did the receiver see. It's not that far away. I don't think the technology is that far away. Could be pretty fun to watch. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back with more. We still have time to talk about the topic of the night, your favorite training camp memories. We've got some tweets that we'll read about that. We started the show by talking about that because, as we said, tomorrow night we're going to be at training camp, believe it or not. And going back all the many years that Bills fans have been attending training camp, whether it's at Niagara University or the Polo Fields in East Aurora or Blaisdell or Fredonia or St. John Fisher College, give us your favorite training camp memories. Phone lines are open for the next few minutes when we return. 803-0550 or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. The John Murphy Show presented by NOCO. Tonight, live from One Bills Drive on Buffalo Bills Radio.
This is the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.
Just a couple minutes left in the show. Tomorrow night we'll be at training camp, and we started out the show by asking, soliciting your thoughts on your favorite training camp memories. We'll do that again in the minutes that remain. The phone line's open, 803-0550 or toll-free 1-888-550-2550. Get to your calls in a moment. A couple of tweets about it, though. Andrew Farrell tweets, in Bledsoe at camp in 2002, was ready for some offensive football. That's a good one. Andy Proven tweets, watching Bruce Smith, when he actually attended, fly off on his golf cart while everyone else stayed to sign autographs. Nah, he stuck around. Mark G tweeted in, as a kid telling James Lofton the Bills and the Packers were both bad, you can come and play here. Years later, he's on the Super Bowl teams. I Love Football Bills tweets, first one was a 2012 night practice. It felt good to be in the presence of the team. Got Fitzpatrick's autograph, too. Yeah, a lot of these memories seem to be people's interaction, which I think is really one of the best things about the training camp, the interaction that you probably are going to have with the players. Ryan Alexander, here's an example. His tweet, my favorite training camp memory was wide receiver Brad Lamb. Remember him? He sat down and talked with me one-on-one for a half hour in Fredonia. Where else is that going to happen but training camp? It's not. It's not. Here's one. Nathan Lopresti tweets, my favorite camp story, a couple of years ago, my buddies and I went. My buddy had a cast on his leg. At the end of practice, Aaron Williams, current player, came over to talk to us. He was asking about my buddy's cast, and we talked for a while. Aaron Williams was so down to earth, so fun to talk to and talk about UT, his alumni. That's the kind of thing that only happens at the training camp. Here's Kathy in Lancaster. Kathy, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I apologize. I just turned the radio on, so I don't know what other stories there were.
Yeah.
But I do remember my godfather was Larry Felser.
Oh.
And I remember getting to go down with my dad to training camp. And I was maybe 12 or 13, and I got to go on the field. And the thing I remember most was Bruce Smith was standing next to us, and I thought how unbelievably big that man was.
Yeah, that's true.
He was huge. And I looked at his arms. I'm thinking his arms were bigger than most people's legs.
Yeah. Larry Felser, your godfather. You know, in some respects, I consider Larry Felser my godfather, too. He was a great man. I miss Larry a lot.
Yeah, he really was. I said, very special. And I will say one thing about him. He had a memory that I don't know anyone else who had a memory like him. He could, I don't even mean for just sports figures, just directions. He could remember when he went down to another state, the corners, things around the corners. It was amazing.
Yeah,
in restaurants. He always knew all the restaurants.
He did know the restaurants. Yeah, thanks, Kathy. I just, last week when I was off, had dinner with Vic Carucci, who used to work with Larry at the Buffalo News and now works for the Cleveland Browns doing a radio show. And we had dinner, and we spent most of our time telling Larry Felser stories because we both really love Larry, love working around him and with him. Mary in Dunkirk. Mary, welcome. You're on the show. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My story makes me laugh every time I think about it. I was in the M&T Bank in Fredonia. The Bills were in town, and I turned around, and what was behind me was huge. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what is that? And it was Bruce Smith. And at the same time, I'm looking at him thinking, he is huge. Oh, my goodness, he is so big. And he looked at me and he said, oh, my goodness, you're pregnant. And I went, how did that happen? I made him laugh because I said, how did that happen?
That's great.
God. It was the best, but great when they were in Fredonia.
It was. Great story, Mary. Thanks. Here's Scott in Williamsville. Scott, do you have a favorite training camp memory?
Oh, yeah. Back when I was really young, it was with O.J. Simpson and Reggie McKenzie. I remember trying to run up to get O.J.'s autograph, and Reggie was just
trotting off the field, and I ended up bumping into him and flying back on my backside. And I remember him picking me up and giving me his autograph.
Wow. Where was that, at Niagara?
I can't remember. A friend of mine took me. I mean, I was
Young. It had to be. It had to be, because I think they moved to Fredonia in 1980. It had to be Niagara University. That's a great story.
It
literally bumped into Reggie McKenzie and bounced off him. It's a great story, Scott. Thanks. Yeah, and it's funny. It's not funny. It's instructive. The stories that we hear from people on the phone, on Twitter, are about the interaction they have with players at training camp. Where else are you going to go in the NFL and get that? A stadium is one thing. You know, the stadium, there's 73,000 people. It's noisy. The game is at hand. It's a supercharged, highly intense atmosphere. Totally different at training camp, both before and after practice. It's laid back. It's relaxed. It's serious business once practice begins, obviously. And for many players, it's life or death in terms of their careers. I mean, what they do on the practice field matters a lot. But there's just a different atmosphere. And I mentioned this the other night. I don't think you wouldn't have that access. You wouldn't get that atmosphere if you didn't go off-site for training camp, as the Bills do, and another, 13 other teams in the NFL. I look forward to it. I look forward to it every year. It's a lot of work for us. There's a lot of driving involved over the next 5 weeks. This training camp in particular is sort of truncated with the visit to Canton early on, and then the three or four days in Pittsburgh. And mid-August, we'll be going there and doing our radio show down there in Pittsburgh when the Bills practice with the Steelers. But I do look forward to it, even though it does signal the end of the summer and the beginning of the new season. I look forward to it. I look forward to the new season as well. So that's where we'll be tomorrow, St. John Fisher College, with Doug Whaley, the Bills general manager, scheduled to be our guest at 7:30 tomorrow. Make sure you tune into that. A lot of good training camp memories tonight. Thanks for sharing that. We want to thank our presenting sponsor, NOCO, family-owned and locally operated since 1933. Explore what NOCO can do for you at NOCO.com. Tom Wright's our engineer tonight. Jay Harris, our producer, and the Bills director of broadcasting is Jeff Matthews. We'll see you tomorrow night. We'll talk to you tomorrow night live from St. John Fisher College in the 2014 Buffalo Bills training camp with the John Murphy Show on Buffalo Bills Radio.